I'm glad you got me, everyone. This is Professor Armin Rao, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, where I taught for 34 years. And one of the classes I taught was Exploitation of the Black African. We want to welcome you to the Conscious Corner, where we're going to be discussing the exploitation of the Black athlete, along with my co-host, Phil Hembrick, who's hopefully will join us, but he's been dealing with some challenges, and he'll join us if possible. I want to welcome Brother Rasha Key, who, well, not welcome, but we give honor and thanks to Rasha Key for sponsoring the Conscious Corner on his Education Network platform, and as well as Brother Mashinda, who's out of Louisiana. Both are very astute students of struggle and activists in their own right, and this is a form of activism by providing a platform where we speak truth to first to the people and then to power and seek truth to ourselves. So we're going to discuss this topic. It's very challenging because most people believe that Black athletes are not exploited. Even the white man said if it wasn't for them, they would be pro athletes and things of this nature, making all the money that they make. And that's, as Joe would say, the illusion of inclusion. So we're going to start off with a discussion, and then we're going to get into some narratives of what that really means. So, Mashinda, how do you feel about the topic, are Black athletes exploited? And if you do accept that they're exploited, explain why. Or if you don't, explain why.
Well, I mean, there's definitely some exploitation going on, you know. In America, you know, the systems of, it's not just sports, it's in many areas of, you know, in the world, or in the United States, or in the world, you know, as far as employment. So sports-wise and athletes, you know, yeah, it's definitely, you know, we've discussed this on other this topic sort of on other podcasts when we were talking about, you know, the white colleges and the Black athlete. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a time where, you know, everybody went to Southern, Grambling, Alcorn, NC, you know all the schools in America that were, you know, the historically Black colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they created a market, you know, when they created a market, when it started generating profits and things like that, you know, they flipped the script. So I think it's a pipe, it's sort of a pipe dream for some that people are fed that, you know, and so when kids are coming up, you know, they playing this, like, and I'm thinking, take football, for instance, you know, it's a contact sport. And there's a lot going on with, you know, I mean, what is that all about? You're tackling people, you're hitting people and things like that. And they've developed it, you know, so they cultivate young kids and develop them. And then, you know, if you're good enough, you play high school. And if you're better, you play in college. And if you're the best, you play in the pros, you know. So only a very small percentage play in a pro. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a, you know, it's almost like it's kind of a lie to a certain degree. Young kids, it's nothing wrong with having dreams and goals and things like that, you know. But at the end of the day, when, you know, most of our, a lot of our people, you know, we focus on sports. When we coming up, we sports, you know, I mean, there's some positiveness, though, when it comes to sports. You know, you learn different things from sports, you know, the different coaches and things like that. So, but from an exploitation standpoint, I believe society has this system in place. Now you're talking a lot of the players that are high profile, you know, they don't really get political. You know, they say a few things. They say, you know, you look at, you know, we talked about Kaepernick in the past on the podcast. You know, he kneeled down and he never played again, you know, and that's the way it is. You get too militant, you're not gonna make it. You know, that's just how it works. You know, so again, they have a design, and you know, we play in it, but those are making multi-millions, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, you know. But there are white people playing sports too, and they getting hit and they playing the same thing. So they're part of it as well. They getting exploited too, you know. You know, their kids are getting exploited too, you know. So, but I mean, again, I could say some positive things about sports and what it did for me, you know. So, but it's definitely a system in place that that's they're making multi-millions, and luckily they have this name, image, and likeness rule now that they can make, if you're worth anything to anybody, they'll let you make some money, you know. So that's a good thing, but 'cause it's not going to be stopped, you know. So my point is, the brothers that are playing ball, if they can make some money, you know, doing a commercial or repping a tennis shoe or something while they're in college, that's a great thing, because they've been getting away with murder, getting away with a lot of money playing. Look, they paid that LSU coach $100 million, you know, to come there, 100 mil for 10 years. And you know, and the players is the one that's on the field, you know, doing all, and you know, and not getting paid. They say, oh, they get a scholarship and they can do all this and that. You know, like I say, that's nonsense. You know, they should get more anyway. But yeah, there is exploitation, you know. That's I'm done for right now.
All right, Rasha Key, what about you?
That is a 100% yes. Black athletes are exploited. Why? Because we live in a system of exploitation. You could go back. I mean, there's many things you can highlight. When you can go back to the slave auction block, and they took those Africans and put them out in front of these slave owners, and they auctioned them off. You could equate that to, and I know it's been said before by numerous people on our show, especially Brother Joe Hembrick. You could equate that to the draft systems. You know, they have these combines where they're watching these athletes work out. And it's just a reflection of the greater society. You take back when you had segregation and you had the Negro baseball leagues. The Negro baseball leagues were better than the white leagues, or you know, the major, the you know, the I've been told, I don't know, 100% accurate, that all-star teams from the Negro Black League played against the major league, and they whooped them white boys. That's what I heard. I wouldn't doubt that. And then you have Branch Rickey of the Dodgers, along with probably some other people, in order for the major leagues to get better than the, in segregation, to get better than the Negro leagues, they started going to the black players and bringing them into the to major leagues. And this is how you broke up the Negro Baseball League, because these players start making money, more money than they was in the Negro Baseball Leagues. So yes, they exploit all the talent of black people, even the inventors. So yes, it's many things that I can mention, if thought about how the African period is exploited. Even the natural resources are taken advantage of in Africa. So yeah, the definitely the athlete is just a byproduct of the greater society in exploitation.
All right. Let me just throw a few things out. Black athletes are exploited because black people are exploited. And they are part of the black population. For instance, they had a there's numerous ways you determine, exploitation is for someone to work or provide services but don't get the benefit. There's more benefits than just money and scholarship. There's social status, social services, social access to institutional activities such as voting, such as education, such as they used to really define exploitation as getting black athletes who weren't eligible to get in college, get them in, and then use them in sports, and then at the end of their careers, they didn't go pro. They didn't get a full education. I remember when I was playing basketball, I was only of the eight black athletes, I was the only one that graduated on time with his class. And matter of fact, I was the only athlete that graduated on time with his class, because even the white boys didn't graduate that were on the team.
Professor Rock, can I tell you
Yeah.
what happened also?
Well, go ahead.
Okay, I didn't graduate with my class, but I went back to school. And when I got my degree, it was an article in the Long Beach Press Telegram saying how I was the third or fourth player in a span of 10 years to get a degree out of the basketball program. So yeah, that's along the lines of what you're talking about. Okay, I just wanted to let you
Oh
know
yeah,
about
well,
that.
congratulations on that. That's very commendable for you to go back. Some schools provide scholarships for athletes to come back, but very few take advantage of it. Because going to school is work. It's institutionalized. It's a 4-year stretch, and it depends on your academic preparations and achievements determine how long you will come back and have to do it. I mean, what's your major? You got to get major requirements. You got to get general ed requirements, and you got to get overall university requirements, and all have to have at least a C average. It depends on what you major in. Things have changed up to this day because many kids come from affluent families, and they get coached not only in basketball, but they get tutors and services because of the education that they got from the history of black athletes that didn't do that or didn't have the resources to do that. But let's give an example. Of the four major teams in the playoff, I think it's Michigan, Georgia, and Alabama, and I forget the other one. Most of those states have discriminatory aspects toward black people. For instance, in Georgia, they voter suppression. So you can play sports for me, but your mom and daddy can't vote. I can yell for you for to make me feel good in a game, but when it comes to sharing power and access to power or institutional participation, you're limited. That's a form of exploitation. Using black athletes to entertain them and provide a sense of euphoria and to draw in box office marquee names to draw in attendance and filling up arenas 100,000 to 200,000. But at the same time, when that athlete leaves the stadium, he's subject to the same racism as the average black person who's not an athlete. You understand? He gets arrested. He gets pulled over. Even James, LeBron James, when he first moved to L.A. in Hollywood, he found graffiti on his garage saying, "Nigga, nigga, this, nigga, that," and he reported it. It didn't make no difference how much money it was and how much and who he was. It had something to do with racism, and so as long as it's racism and discrimination, regardless of how an athlete performs on any level, may it be Pop Warner, may it be a Little League baseball, may it be a community, junior high in a high school competition, and may it be The same thing with regards to high school. High schools make money. They charge a ticket and things of this nature, build up their student body fund. And then at the same time, there's a struggle. So you do a parallel analysis. In other words, you equate the achievement and the participation of sports or any form of entertainment of Black people and their social condition, educational condition, and political condition and economic condition. And when you look at that parallel, okay, when Jackie Robinson got in the Major League Baseball, the first so-called first Black person to be in it, you go back into that year that he was inducted into the Dodgers thing. And then you, I think it was the Brooklyn Dodgers at that time, then you begin to say, well, what was the condition in the social institutional condition of Black people in America? So you look at their voting rights, you look at their educational attainment, you look at their economic attainment, and things of this nature. Now, Jackie Robinson was able to make some money, but the overall condition of Black people, police abuse was still going on, lynching was still going on at that time. And so there's a thing, you can come to play sports with me. And like Rusty was saying, plantations, whereas even the slave owner and the people that enslaved Black people, that was their property, so they protect them. In other words, they tell people if they catch him or if they ran away, you know, don't hurt him. I got to keep him working. They don't beat him. Don't maim him. You know, if he had ran away and they caught him, bring him back. That's my property. They even hired slave hunters to go do that. And so it's a struggle. And see, most people are blind by the economic powers. And, they got at least three Black billionaires that was in athletics, LeBron James, Michael Jordan, and I think Tiger Woods, and I think there's one more, I can't remember who it is, four billionaires. And they Magic, okay. And so they put that out there, and they only represent a percentage of the Black community. You know, I asked Machina, has he traveled through Louisiana? And he said he has, and I know he saw poverty. He saw deep poverty. Even today, the majority of the homeless are Black people. The majority of those that are incarcerated are Black people. So the concept of putting Black athletes out there make people think we're living good, and way overpaid over this, and they make us think we need to pay them to be in this society. Now, there has been a revolt. In 68, there was a revolt of the Black athletes. Harry Edwards wrote the book about it. But most of them were retired athletes, some of them, in that time, except for Bill Russell and Jim Brown, I think, had retired. I don't know if he had retired then or not. I think he did. As well as Kareem Jabbar, he wasn't retired. And then there was a few other athletes that joined in the boycott of the Olympics and called for a boycott of the Olympics. And that's the year they had junior college cats play in front in the Olympics rather than college. That's where Spencer Haywood went. And he was in junior college at that time. And a few other athletes went who were in junior college. And I think they won gold medal. But at that same time, realize that there was a revolt in the Olympics. After that, there was no more follow-up. There was no revolt of other issues that we face. But at the same time, the exploitation is a parallel analysis that I was saying of the condition of all Black, of Black people in general. You know, you can pick out, they pick out the best athletes, the best scholars, and getting them special scholarships, special notoriety, and a privilege. Even Ralph Bunche is the one that signed the proclamation to give Israel part of Palestine or let them live in Palestine. And Ralph Bunche was and then they gave him the Nobel Peace Prize. So, you know, there's a lot of that going on. I remember we had Craig Hodges on, and he talked about how, you know, he went and gave Bush a note, and they whiteballed him from sports because they had won the championship. He wore African dashiki. They told him not to wear it. And he gave him a note saying, you know, treat African Americans better. And I don't know, I know that was a part of the note. And he was whiteballed from basketball. And none of the athletes came to his aid, you know, or participated in that. So, you know, we deal with those forms of exploitation, using them to sell their products now. You got black athletes selling beer, selling other forms of insurance, doing all kind of stuff for white industries to get black people to buy them and things of this nature. But at the same time, you as a black person don't own a team. Don't, I mean, outright own it by themselves. You know, there's a few people that got percentages of teams of pro sports. And the same thing with regards to college sports. The black colleges play in a division by which it's very seldom that they are in the conference with Caucasian institutions or the Big Ten or the Big Nine or all of that, regardless of how successful they were, especially down in Louisiana with Grambling, when Eddie Robinson was, I think that was his name, was the coach, and they were the championship team all the time. These schools wouldn't even schedule him to play him. And so those are the issues that we look at, because they didn't want to give them the status of being equated with the European or Caucasian sport. So, Machinda, how do you feel about that analysis? You there, Machinda? We can't hear you.
May have stepped away.
Okay, go ahead, Roger King.
Oh, well, it was an excellent analysis.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of backed what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And yeah. And now I can't pinpoint one single thing that you said that was incorrect. And sound like it was back in class about 30 years ago. Yeah, it was I don't have much to say about that. I agree with you. And it makes sense. You know, it makes sense.
You see, one time sports were required, they had a grooming code, clean shaven, generally flat top of Cavada's haircut. At one time, you had to be, you know, there's patrioticism. That's what the Star Spangled Banner before every game is about. And that's what presidents throwing out the first ball in baseball or making appearances at the sporting events is all about. So you got the politics. But the economic aspect of it is challenging, because most people think when one black athlete's a billionaire, all of them are. And that's not true. The majority of the expand, most black athletes, pro athletes, last 3 years. The average is 3 years of pro sports before they're gone. And then many of them go broke, maybe homeless, many of them, because they've been taken care of all their time. And when I went to college, Tarkanian them filled out the athlete's application, filled out their finance, people fill out their financial aid applications, and picked their classes. And I chose my own classes, you know. And you know, at that time we just wanted to play, and they want you to stay eligible. So they put you in classes that you didn't have to attend, and they sometimes get you a job and you still get a grade, even though you hadn't been a day to school. They got coaches that taught academic classes. I remember George Trapp was a good brother, good athlete. He was a senior eligibility-wise, but a sophomore academically with regards to his major. You know, he hadn't finished his GEs, he hadn't finished his major requirements, you know, but he was a senior player, eligibility-wise. In those days, you couldn't come back and play once your 4 years was up. And then at the same time, the European broke high schools down. You realize that black high schools were dominating that CIF and state championships and track, football, and basketball. And so what did he do? At one time, you only could go to the school that you lived in the neighborhood. There was this white man changed the rules, so you can go to any school you want to go to, so that he could recruit black athletes from predominantly black schools. So you had some black athletes playing for white, predominantly white schools, and standing out and helping them win championships, because they'd give them scholarships, especially the parochial schools and private schools, whereas they are like Bourbon Day and like St. Bernard's and like Sarah High School. Those were generally Catholic schools meant for all white folks and Latinos. But then they saw sports made them money for their student body and gave them status and recognition. So they broke down the barrier and they became outstanding athletes. You listen to these schools, and even in the empire, there are coaches that, and systems that move whole families out if they really want you into an area. Colleges would send you to junior college and pay your tuition until you got eligible. All of those things were part of the whereas you think they're doing you a favor, but you're doing them a favor once you go there. When you talk about Sidney Wicks, who went to Santa Monica High School for UCLA, and he, you know, that was their place to place him, then transferred him into UCLA. And there was just a lot of athletes that benefited from a philanthropic and the role of boosters. You know, the word is that they got, at that time, Lewison, a special made Mercedes because of his height, and he was driving that. And you know, how do these schools get these athletes? There's something like Reggie Bush, you know, agents and other people would pay them and pay their families and things of that nature while they're in school and things of this nature. And then they're going to take his Heisman Trophy and all his awards of that season because they said he got paid NCAA. And the NCAA makes trillions of dollars off black athletes. They expand playoffs. You know, at one time you win your conference that and you get ranked. That's how you've gotten to the playoffs. Now it's a whole new difference. You can be a losing team and win a tournament and be eligible to go to a playoff. Even though a team that's in your same conference is ranked higher than you, but they didn't win the tournament, both of y'all would go. And so it's a thing of them, the most high-profile athletes in the major sports, may it be boxing, may it be football, may it be basketball. It's African American. They make up close to 60 to 70% of the athletes in football, 60 to 70% of the athletes in basketball, maybe even more, 80%. And so it's and so they start going overseas. But the point is that the white boy, sometime on the bench, make more than the black athlete playing. And I think that was Kupchak that played for the Lakers. He was making more than the players playing when he was on the bench, and then became an administrator by marrying the owner's daughter or something. And so they have more. They might have more recognition than you find the black athlete. So, Mashinda, you back yet?
Professor Rob, before Mashinda say something, I just want to speak to what you were saying when you said that when the athletes are playing, or the college athletes are playing, they did a lot for them, and it enables you to not be able to know what's going on when it comes to your own academics. I had an experience that kind of happened with me when I was playing for the team. I had an academic advisor, but once I went back to school to finish the degree, I was on my own. And right at the end of my program for to get the degree, it was some procedures I needed to do that I wasn't aware of. And being in that position of where they were taking care of everything, and then going transitioning to being on my own, I didn't know what was going on. And my Alana Karanga, Dr. Karanga, he kind of got a little upset at me because I didn't know one of the procedures, and I had to let him know that I was basically ignorant to the fact that I needed to go through him to get something signed, you know. And it kind of cripples some people when they take care of you like that, instead of, you know, they do a lot for you, but also you would have to be somebody that asks a lot of questions and you know, kind of do things for yourself, kind of be self-sufficient. But, you know, they enabled me. And I fell victim to that, but you know, you learn and grow.
All right, you can put me back on.
It's not letting you come on. Okay.
No,
you got it now. Okay. Yeah. There. All right.
Let me just say this. You send our black people to the surface. They Joe Lewis, Muhammad Ali, when he was at his top of his boxing, because he refused to go, they took his championship away from him for close to 4 or 5 years until he went through the Supreme Court. And because he was a Muslim minister, he had a religious objection upheld. But in them years, he, you know, that was his prime of his year. And he was making money for everyone. But that's the key to their strategy. Because he changed his name to Muhammad Ali, and because he was outspoken about, you know, he was a friend of Malcolm X, all of a sudden he gets drafted. It's not an accident. You know, at the height of Joe Lewis, he had to go to the service. When Jesse Owens won the Olympics, he had to come back. And the only job he could get was with the circus, racing horses. Then the next thing they had him doing is selling the South African Krugerrand, a gold coin, that supported apartheid. These are some vicious methodologies that have no consciousness. They normalize evil. They normalize it to the point that people accept it. You know, they accepted our discrimination. The majority of white folks do in this society. It's like they're accepting the evil that's going on in Palestine and Gaza right now. You understand? Spending billions of dollars, talking about spending billions of dollars in Ukraine for war, billions of dollars in giving to Israel, what they already give billions of dollars to, and they haven't even suffered. Nowhere near what the Palestinians. Then they'll give contracts for people to come in and rebuild the damage that they've done to God. And the Europeans will make big money coming in, restoring their infrastructure, getting rid of the rubble, finding more bodies. And then, you know, I mean, you have to, how is there not more outcry in America? Because they're normal to violence. They're normal to exploitation and abuse, and they're normal to the propaganda that the institutions that protect those that are doing the evil and support them by saying it's defense. They're defending themselves. How are you defending yourself bombing churches, bombing schools, bombing hospitals, bombing citizens, saying they're human shield? No, you're targeting all of that. Now, you understand? So,
Professor Rowe, can I jump in?
Yes.
Now, on the Level Set show, they were having this discussion, the same discussion about the Israel and Palestine conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, they asked for a humanitarian pause in the UN.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the United States. They didn't vote for it.
They
voted
vetoed.
Against it. They vetoed it. And you, I think it was England, they abstained. So, and then they were saying, they had mentioned, you know, why wouldn't they want to have a humanitarian, or what you call a humanitarian pause? I said, well, how can, if you're not, how could they have a humanitarian pause if they're not human? So, so my thing is if you are truly human, you wouldn't do what you're doing. So I just made a blanket statement like that. And one thing is, how can you deny that? It's like, how can you deny that a human wouldn't do that? So there's something going on that where you could almost say that these people are not human.
Yeah, C.V. Williams said, "What type of people are this?"
I sent the text to Dr. Charles Alexander. I'm gonna be putting up the video that they did from Saturday on Level Set Show, and those brothers have real good commentary and very good points that they make about conflicts, and they have a lot of history that they discuss. So yeah, it's a challenge to even call anybody with that type of mentality human.
Well, like I said, man, and the propaganda that the society does allow Israel to cut off all news reporters, blackout of all news reporting, unless they edit what it goes out, all videos, satellite information, and things of this nature. They have to give the narrative of what it represents. But still, some gets out. And you know, we commend those that are out there demonstrating worldwide. But America's supposed to believe in democracy, and the majority is supposed to rule. So if the majority of the United Nations voted for a a ceasefire, and America vetoed it. That's the dynamic that we have to look at. And you know, why would you say you're a democratic society, but then you act like a minority? And that's why they invented the Electoral College, to make sure white folks determine who will be in the White House, or what delegates would be able to determine who's going to be the president. And so, you know, minority rule, because they're the minority in the world. And so they've figured out systems to be power brokers, even though they're the minority, but then they profess that they believe in democracy as long as you vote the way they want you to vote. You know, I mean, we for years, well, you know, it's always a white man for president, you know, and it still is, you know, for the most part, our black person to act like a white man, from a white majority party that tells that black man what to do, you know, and so it's a form of that. But getting back to the athletes, most of them are not politically activists. They do it once they retire. But, you know, even the culminate thing, you know, they kneeled and wore a glove and spoke a little bit, but none of them really boycotted and said it was unfair how they was treating them, even in the NFL, you know, because the money supports their family that they make. The money supports their lifestyle. And that's more important than social justice to them. You know, their economic standards, and the European act like it's a privilege to be a pro athlete. And less than 1% of black people play pro athletes. You know, we're 22 million people or more. And some say 30 or 40 million, undercounted. And you know, what makes up the pro athletes and college athletes? Less than 4 or 5% of us. When you go to college, the majority of black people do not play sports. You understand? They're in academic classes or vocational classes. You understand? But I was 15 players on a basketball team at the most. If you count coaches, assistant coaches, or whatever, let's say it's 20 people on a pro team, on a college team, nationwide, that are black. You know, the majority of colleges are small and white, and there are no black people there. You understand? And they play just under 2A or BA or, you know, small age things, and that's why they are, they, you know, they make money. They play in gyms, they play in small arenas, but they're making money. But the beautiful thing is that they're not. There's no black people there, and they want to keep it that way. You understand? You know, you look at the majority of colleges, they're in small rural white areas, small little private white colleges. And then, but those are in cities like Whittier, Loyola, they'll get black athletes. But most of those Catholic schools throughout the nation don't have no black athletes. And the point is that they're still making money off sports. But when it comes down to our black people that's participating in sport, they get no social status and no social economic and educational attainment. Even once they get their education, some of them, if they don't go into entrepreneurship, you know, it's very difficult for them to find employment, especially if they didn't get academic preparation or vocational preparation. And then they come out and they say, well, do you have a degree? No, but I got units. And it's very difficult for them when they get exploited and misused. They turn to drugs, they turn to alcohol. And many of them get divorced, pro athletes go bankrupt. I mean, it goes through changes. They marry white girls and they sue them and take their money, you know, get half of what they earn, you know. And it's just a dynamic that it consists of so many elements. It'll confuse you if you try to say they exploit it. But if you break it down and do some statistical analysis, you'll be able to see the exploitation. But other than that, it's camouflage by putting them on commercials, by putting them at a high profile of people that go to the White House and eat hors d'oeuvres on the White House lawn and things of that nature with the president. And, you know, it's a challenge. So, you know, that's mainly it, Roger Key. You know, we're going to talk about what's come on Wednesday. I think, you know, we covered most of the subject.
Okay, so, you know, we have the anniversary, our third-year anniversary tomorrow for the CEN show.
Yeah, I can't looking forward to that.
Yeah, you know. So we're going to have a nice little chat about what we do. And give a little bit more information out than I usually do.
Okay, then we're going to have Dr. Marlana Karenga on. We haven't settled the date, but sometime this month to discuss the origin and history of Kwanzaa and what the seven principles are and how he created it. And, you know, because I can tell you some things, but still, I'd rather for him to do it. So that's about it.
That'd be a treat for us. Get us a big shot.
Okay. I'm going to try to get Molefe Asante on.
Yeah.
You know, talk about his thing. But we'll expand next at this month and the beginning. We'll be getting some Dr. Sensalo, who's from Uganda, to talk about his travels and his to Uganda to feed the people and do things. So we're going to have a real entree of excellent scholars going into the next year.
Looking forward to it, Professor Ra.
All right,
so each one teach one, Conscious Corner. Don't take our pause.